I want to thank this episode's sponsor, Castellanets LLP, a leading law firm in tax controversy, white-collar criminal defense, and government negotiations, with offices in New York City and Washington, D.C. Visit www.kflaw.com.
This is the podcast for women who want to create careers and lives they love. I'm your host, Heather Fincher. Welcome to the Powerful Professional Women podcast. If you want to create a career in life you love, then you're in the right place. I'm an attorney practicing tax law in Washington, D.C., and I started this podcast because I'm on a quest to learn everything I can from successful professional women, and I want to share that journey with you. I want you to be empowered, informed, and inspired by the women on this podcast because I want us all to win, and every woman's path to success is her own. So take what works for you and set aside the rest. I'm thrilled to have Joan Arnold on the podcast today in front of a live audience to tell her story and provide actionable insights on grit. Joan is a partner at Troutman Pepper and chair of the firm's Tax and Benefits Practice Group. A well-known leader of the tax bar, Joan has been teaching at law school graduate programs for over 30 years, and she's served in numerous other leadership positions, including president of the American College of Tax Counsel, and I personally met Joan when she was head of the American Bar Association section of taxation, where she and I co-founded the ABA's Women in Tax Forum. Joan, thank you for joining us. I'm so happy and excited to have you on the podcast today.
A pleasure to be here, Heather. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. So looking back over your successful career, 45 years as a tax lawyer, what do you see as a theme that you would say runs through the years?
First of all, I'm still utterly surprised that it's been 45 years. And maybe that's the good thing, that it surprises me I've been doing this for this long. But when you first asked me that question and I had to think about it, there were two things. One, and this wasn't a word that was used when I was looking at my career going forward, but it was being gritty and taking chances. I haven't always been comfortable in the positions or roles in which I found myself. And I had to learn how to work through that to get comfortable and to embrace what was being offered to me.
Yes. Take us back, Joan. When was a moment earlier in your career when something impacted you and you needed to be gritty?
Maybe I better start with my background because it kind of puts it into context. I was not to the manor born as a tax lawyer or as a lawyer or anything else. My mom was a legal secretary. And from the time that I was about 12 or 13, she was raising three children alone on a legal secretary's salary. We didn't get the Wall Street Journal. I didn't know what the Wall Street Journal was. And my introduction to economics was the fact that you often had to buy Macintosh apples as opposed to delicious apples, because they were less expensive, but you needed to have an apple. My maternal grandparents were Italian immigrants who came over in their 20s. And my mom's first language was Italian. She didn't speak English for a number of years. Talk about being gritty and taking chances. She was not allowed to go to school beyond high school. It simply was not permitted for a daughter of an Italian family to go to college. Even though she had all kinds of offers and scholarships. She was extremely smart. So she put herself out in the business world, and she was soon taking some really interesting positions and taking on a lot of responsibility for which she had no formal background. But she decided that that was what she was going to do. And she became a legal secretary. We always referred to her as a lawyer without a license. Because when I finally figured out what a lawyer did and I figured out what she did, I said, my God, you were doing it all as a lawyer, but you didn't have a license to do that. She said, yeah, but I needed to. We needed the financial resources. You know, in the early 1970s, she wanted to buy a house. Women in New York were not allowed to apply for a mortgage in their own name at that point in time. So she had to figure out how to get a mortgage so that she could buy the house so that she could live the way we wanted to. Well, what a learning experience it was to be her daughter and being raised in that household. She unfortunately passed away about 10 years ago, but I still find when I'm in a challenging situation, I talk to her and I ask her what I should be doing. And you may not be able to hear her, but I could hear her. And I think that learning grittiness and taking chances from her was the best experience I could have had.
Amazing.
But back to my grittiness. You asked me when we started to talk about this to explain examples of grittiness. So it was 1979, beginning of 79, and I was working at my first job at Citicorp, the First National City Bank of New York. That's how long ago it was. And I was working with a UK tax advisor, and I was putting together a model of what would happen if we undertook certain transactions. And it was clear that to this UK tax advisor, I was too young and too female to be given much of a consideration. So I put together the materials and I sent it over to him. And I asked him very politely if he would get on the phone and talk to me about them. So he rings me up and I get on the phone and he says to me, "There's no such thing as depreciation." And he hangs up the phone. So I go back and I look back to my UK resources and I look again and I try it differently. And I say, "Mr. So-and-so, could we talk about the fact that the value of the asset will go down? There's no such thing as asset going down or value or depreciation." And he hangs up the phone.
Oh my goodness.
So one more time, I go back to the books and I read the UK description of what I'm trying to do. And I called him back and I said, "Mr. So-and-so, are my calculations of capital allowances correct?" And he said, "Yes, they're very well done." Because in his mind, it was a capital allowance. It wasn't depreciation. So it was a very interesting story that made me understand just what grittiness meant. Was my first experience with grittiness.
I appreciate, I love hearing how you, you didn't take it any personally. You're just like,
personally.
Well, you got over it.
I could not answer it. I still didn't get it done.
But you knew you were talking about. You just had to find his language and you kept pushing and making that possible.
A lot of it was informed. I was a math major in college. And you might remember, whether you remember it fondly or not, you might remember when you took geometry, when you did a proof. When you got to the end of the proof, you could write QED in capital letters. The thing speaks for itself. You could write that because you had completed the proof and proven out the hypothesis. To me, getting to QED is what a tax lawyer aims at. And to me, that's what makes it the grittiness to say, I can't give up until I can write QED. Just like I couldn't as a math major give up until, I did finally. I was a senior and I finally figured out I was not going to learn the fourth dimension. It just wasn't working for me. But it's kind of informed my entire approach to my career, like getting to QED.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us more about that. How did that develop in you, or did anyone else impact you in that area?
Some of it could have been the way I approached the beginning of my career. I was, for personal reasons, living in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, working in Manhattan. So I commuted on a daily basis from Bucks County to Manhattan. And during the first 3 years, I was also getting my LLM, my advanced degree in tax law at NYU. So I would, on NYU days, I would get the 7 o'clock train from Trenton up to New York. Then I would work all day. I would go down to NYU and then I would hoof it back to Penn Station and get the 11 o'clock train back to Pennsylvania. And then the next morning, I would do the whole thing all over again.
Talk about being gritty. Let's just acknowledge. Wow.
That was a bit of being gritty, but it didn't mean not to do it. I wanted to be the best I could in my career, and that's what it took. And I was really richly rewarded for it. I came across some of the brightest minds I could imagine in that time period. And I'm not just me because of tax substance. They were all extraordinarily brilliant when it came to tax law. But they honestly, I got exposed to ideas. One of them was from Charlie Kingston, who unfortunately is no longer with us, but was in my mind one of the great deans of international tax. And Charlie, in his inimitable way, said in the first class, "Okay, the only thing you have to agree to take this class, is that you are going to undertake a willing suspension of disbelief." The suspension of disbelief is a theater term to describe how you are seeing a set because you go into a Broadway play and it looks like it's a living room, not a living room. It's a set, but you suspend the disbelief and you say, okay, it's a living room. So when Charlie taught me this phrase and taught me what it meant it really changed the way I focused my thinking. And it has informed me all the time. It's like, in my mind, anything can be true. So when I go into a planning opportunity, or I have a client who says something that sounds a little off to me, it can be true. I have to prove it or disprove it, but it can be true. And that's really how it has, it really impacted my life. And that whole experience in the graduate program and finding people who thought about ideas was really crucial to me. So it's a major mindset for me. I keep an open mind. Anything is possible. And I work hard to figure out if I can write QED.
Oh, what an amazing approach. Just because we can so often block ourselves, I think, if we think something can or can't be true or should be a certain way. But when we actually open to possibility, that's an amazing approach.
Thanks. My kids like it.
Oh.
See, it keeps my mind real open.
Do you dare share any of those stories?
No. No, I promise them I would never publicize them.
All right, let's circling back to your first job in-house with Citibank. Tell us if you came across, did you come across a crossroads where you needed to be, to again, lean on that grittiness and believe in yourself that anything was possible?
Yeah, it was. Now, remember, I mentioned that I was not to the amount of one. I had never read the Wall Street Journal. I fell into my first job. I had gone to law school to be a juvenile justice advocate. And I did that for a while through the legal services clinic while I was in law school and found that it was not an appropriate career for me. It was in the 70s. What the lawyers needed, what the children needed, not so much lawyers, they needed social services, and there was no money. And I really couldn't have the impact I wanted to have, and it was eating up my stomach. So I turned from that, and then I said, I don't know what I'm going to do now. But I had to figure something out. And I had the opportunity for a summer job at Citicorp after my first summer, which was, they just needed a body. Well, they needed a body that could figure something out. It was actually a pretty interesting job. They gave me a room, probably about an 18 by 20 room that was filled with cardboard boxes. Inside the boxes were income tax receipts. And my job was to match the income tax receipts with the loans that had created the taxes. And if I won, the company got untold millions of dollars in foreign tax credits. And if I lost, they didn't. I get to the QED. We worked to the point where, and I worked with some phenomenal people on that, to where they got what they needed. And I had said, when I was asked if I would take this job, now I needed this job. I had no background for this job, but it didn't stop me when they offered me the job and I realized what it was. I said, I'm happy to do this, but if I finish early, could I join the legal intern program? It was the end of my first summer of law school. And they said, sure. So I finished early and I joined the legal intern program in the tax department.
And I love that you asked.
Well, that's...
I love that you... Yeah.
I'm going to offer it. So then they offered me a job after that for the next summer. And then that was what I came back to. It was an interesting time for my first job. Then on to my first real career job, I had a wonderful mentor. His name was Al Grotel. He was the VP of tax at Citibank. And I would get restless. I was at Citi for 10 years. That was a long tenure. I started out doing business taxes for our non-US offices, which was a lot of fun. So learning the Greek system was a lot of fun. But then what happened was that I got a little bored with that. And I had had a recruiter reach out to see if I would consider changing jobs. So I went to Al and I said, this is what I've been offered. And he said, let's think about this a little bit. And he said, are you bored? I said, yeah, I'm a little bored. He said, do you like the environment? I said, I love the environment. He said, why are you bored? I said, I'm not learning anything anymore. It's too slow. And he said, what would you rather be doing? And I looked around and I said, well, I'd really like to do some financial work. So he put me on the desk where we did the Eurobonds, the issuance of the bonds that Citibank would raise outside of the United States. And I got very involved in that. And then I got involved in financial products. It was a time in life when we saw the beginning of swaps, when we saw the beginning of what ultimately would become PFIX. And it was a really heady time. I got to keep doing many different things. So I had five different jobs while I was there for 10 years. It was a great learning experience. But each time, Al said to me, you tell me when you want to change, you know, and you tell me why, and you tell me where you want to go. Because his rule was, you can walk into my office with a problem anytime, so long as you have a solution. So I took him up on that, and I did it for 10 years. But then what happened, I was commuting from Pennsylvania back to Manhattan every day. Then our first child was born. And that wasn't really, you couldn't do that. I did it for like 8 months, and I couldn't do it anymore after that. So I turned to something else that I really enjoyed doing, which is communicating. In my case, it's teaching. So I was teaching in the LLM programs at a couple of schools, and Rutgers Camden asked me to come on and teach full-time to basically incorporate what was called the McCrate Report, which was the first time, this was in the mid-80s, early 80s, this was the first time that the American Bar Association Accreditation Board said law schools need to do a better job of teaching students how to be lawyers. So I was brought in to try and do that in the tax function. And it was a great time. I really enjoyed it. I really loved the students. I probably wasn't a great academician because I changed my course every semester. One semester, I taught the entire course out of KKR's takeover of RJR Nabisco. It was a lot of fun.
What I'm picking up is you need to keep things interesting for yourself.
Didn't you
graduate school like super early? And I mean, just... Yeah, outrageously smart person and how
My mother's view when I was in college, well, first of all, I had the opportunity to skip some grades in middle school. And my mother saw no reason for me to waste time taking those classes. So I skipped the grades. And then I got to college and I came home the first semester and she said, can I please see your schedule? And I showed it to her and she said, how many classes a week are you going to? I had 18 credits. She said, no. You know, like, and another course every semester. So I took like 24 to 26 credits a semester because otherwise, why not? So grittiness was built in early. I decided in the 80s that, I decided in the 90s after having taught for 8 years, I missed clients and I wasn't tenure track because I don't fit that mold. I needed a more remunerative position. And I looked around and thankfully my teaching had paid off. And one of my former LLM students was a tax partner at Pepper Hamilton. And I told her I was looking to come out of academia and she brought me to Pepper. And I came in as a partner. At that point in time, somebody dubbed me the Immaculate Partner because I'd never been an associate. And I've been doing it ever since. You know, and you talk about taking chances and are you swinging above your weight? I had never been a partner.
That's a very different.
So the partner who brought me in called me and she said, are you nervous? I said, well, I certainly hope you expect my answer to be yes, because if I'm not nervous, I don't have any feelings. I'm nervous about this. What's the phrase? If you don't try, you can't succeed mightily. So I figured the worst that could happen is it didn't work. You want me to tell you the one story I told you about that? What happens when you agree to go and sit someplace you're not completely comfortable?
Yes.
So I get to the firm, and there's a brand new tax law that's been enacted about 6 months before. It deals with S corporations, which are supposed to be small corporations. Now, I came from Citibank, which is not a small corporation, and in which we didn't really notice that we had shareholders. They just weren't relevant to our daily life. So I get to the firm and I'm asked to please handle this transaction. It was a sale of an S corporation for about $500 million. That's not small to me, but they have shareholders. We need to worry about the shareholders. So I pay some attention to it and I learn it a little bit. And I go up to New York to negotiate it with the tax lawyers on the other side. And I'm meeting with a man who I know is a dean of the New York tax bar because he was an NYU professor, et cetera. Neither one of us know anything about S corporations. And we're sitting there, and there's a very young female associate sitting in the meeting with both of us. And after a while, talk about a woman who's willing to take chances, she piped up and she said, neither one of you know what you're talking about. I, however, know exactly what you need to know. So I'm going to put together the materials that we need and I'll get back to you. And she stood up and she left the room. And the older gentleman and I both kind of went, oh, damn it, she didn't do that for both of us. And then I got her stuff and I spent my 12 hours learning it and vetting it and everything else. She is now a senior partner at one of the New York Wall Street firms.
Of course, right.
So, it's always a great story to tell.
It's a great story to tell. And just thinking about being gritty, taking chances. Like, I wonder how much of her willingness to just step up, I feel like you create the space for people. You welcome people to do the same around you, Joan. And I just wonder if you had that impact on her, that the space you actually created in that room was for her, safe for her to be like, yeah, I've got it. I'll report.
I would like to think that, but I tend to think she was just frustrated with the two of us. They do their own trying to make a safe space for people I'm working with. Whether it's on their personal level or whether it's on their professional level. Because I think that that's the best way to lead.
I definitely want to hear more, but I think I want to dive into that in part two. I think we wrap up part one here, dive into that. But Joan, are there any other thoughts or insight you have around actionable insights for other professional women out there who want to be gritty like you, to take chances in these ways?
I think you have to raise your hand and ask for what you want. I don't know if it's very different in professional life as it is in personal life. I've never been a great believer in saying my husband should know what I want. Not a mind reader. And same thing in a business life. If you need to raise your hand, ask for what you want. I don't think anybody's going to know what you want. And most people are not there to serve you. You know, you're kind of in charge of you. The worst people can do is say no. So I think that, and if you've positioned yourself right, they'll say yes. So raise your hand and ask for what you want.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Joan, for sharing your story, experience, and insights with us. I also want to thank our live audience who have been with Joan and me today for all of your support, positive energy, and just wonderful presence. I'm grateful to each one of our listeners. I hope you leave this episode inspired and empowered to be your most powerful professional self.
I want to thank this episode's sponsor, Castellanos LLP, a leading law firm in tax controversy, white-collar criminal defense, and government negotiations, with offices in New York City and Washington, D.C. Visit www.kflaw.com.